Thank you, John, for that wonderful introduction, and it is indeed a pleasure to be here with you and to be here at this wonderful, wonderful school. Let me tell a quick story about Professor Cannon. Tell a story about how he set something in motion almost 20 years ago that now has the U.S. Congress embroiled in a fierce debate over the authority of the EPA. So you heard that John and I worked together at the EPA, and back then, as you heard, as it is now, EPA was under a lot of attack from Congress. And one of the people leading these attacks was a gentleman named Tom DeLay. He was then the House Majority Leader. You may remember him from Dancing with the Stars, where he didn't do so well. But as administrator, I would be frequently called up to testify before Congress, and Mr. DeLay was on one of our important committees, and one day he was peppering me, grilling me with questions about greenhouse gases, and then he started accusing me of regulating greenhouse gases, and finally I looked at him and I said, we're not regulating them, we're studying them. We're not regulating them, we're studying them. That's what EPA does. We study things, we look at the science. But the exchange sort of escalated, and eventually he said to me, Mr. DeLay said, well, do you even think you have the authority to regulate greenhouse gases? And I said, well, you know, I don't know. I said, the words don't appear in the Clean Air Act, I don't know. But I said, you know, I'm happy to take a look and we can send you a memo. So we did, we took a look, and we concluded that in fact the Clean Air Act does allow EPA to regulate greenhouse gases. And as you know, as students of the law, the Supreme Court ultimately agreed with our conclusion and found that if EPA determined that greenhouse gases endanger public health and the environment, then EPA actually had an obligation to regulate greenhouse gases. And so the important thing to know is that memo is commonly referred to as the Cannon memo because it was written by John Cannon. And so, John, 20 years later, it's because of you, there is this debate in Congress about how and whether EPA should regulate greenhouse gases. And so I thank you for your very insightful and important reading of the Clean Air Act. It was 41 years ago that over 20 million Americans across the country took to their park, their streets, their neighborhoods, in one of the largest national demonstrations in the history of our country. It was the first Earth Day, April 22nd, 1970. And in community after community, Americans were demanding that, as a people, we protect those things we all share. We protect the safety of our air, our land, our water. And I think it was fair to say that that day, the modern environmental movement was born. Later that year, Richard Nixon created the EPA, sparking an unprecedented bipartisan legislative effort to establish federal anti-pollution safeguards. Now, prior to that time, most of our pollution efforts had been left to the states. But in many instances, the immediate pressures in the states of creating jobs, the demands of local business, the need to grow, had simply proven more important than actually protecting our environment. And city after city, state after state had essentially failed in their efforts to protect the air, the land, and the water. By 1970, our city skylines were so polluted that in many places it was impossible to see from one city skyscraper to another. I once, in one of my travels at EPA, I once met an older gentleman who told a story of how, as a young lawyer, when he would go off to work in the morning in downtown Pittsburgh, he would actually take a second white shirt because by noontime his shirt was so soiled from the pollution that it was no longer white. And so he would change into a clean white shirt for his afternoon appointments. We once had a river that was so fouled with raw sewage and toxic chemicals that it caught on fire. The Cuyahoga River literally caught on fire. Human waste in the Potomac River flowed by the Lincoln Memorial. And so there was this great sense of urgency. There was this great commitment. There was this desire to really do right by the environment. Now, it wasn't as if we hadn't done some things. In 1916, we had created the National Park Service, which gives us such beautiful places that we can visit with our families on vacation. In 1918, Congress had adopted the Federal Migratory Bird Treaty. Women at the time, it was high fashion to wear beautiful feather plumes in their hats, and this was leading to the extinction of many bird species, and so Congress had actually stepped forward and banned the sale of plumes. But when it came to the pollution of our air, our water, our land, we had ignored even the most basic steps. Instead, we chose to believe that nature could actually solve the problem. There's a saying, probably many of you know it, a solution to pollution is dilution. If we just build those smokestacks a little higher, the air pollution would float up and away. If we could bury the waste out of sight, it would be out of mind. But with the first Earth Day, the nation began the difficult task of cleaning our environment. We set out to protect the world we live in and the one our children will inherit. I think it's important to recognize that it was really a moral and ethical obligation, and it was a broadly held commitment. It was a national consensus, people demanding that their government protect those things we share. It was a bipartisan commitment. This was not a Democrat or a Republican issue. It was a commitment that was broadly held among the American people and their elected representatives. It was in some ways a core, it was becoming a core American value. It's fair to say that we've made a lot of progress in those 40 some years. Our skies are certainly clearer, our waste, our water is cleaner, the toxic waste dumping has been banned, the hole in the upper ozone may actually be healing. And because John mentioned some of the decisions we made during the 90s at EPA, cars and trucks run cleaner, toxic fumes from 18-wheelers and trucks are vastly reduced, our air is improving. But it doesn't mean we're done, and it doesn't mean that there's not more to do. I think there probably were those people 41 years ago when we began this effort of protecting the environment who thought the day would come when we could simply check it off the national to-do list. Environment clean, air safe, water clear, let's move on to something else. But I think there were also those and many more who understood that the task and the job of environmental protection is not one that can be completed in a year, a decade, or even a lifetime. That instead there was an ongoing responsibility of environmental protection, and it was a responsibility that will always be with us. I believe it is a responsibility made even greater today when we consider the magnitude of climate change, a challenge that is not as easily crystallized as those of the 70s. The challenge of climate change is obviously greater than the challenges we faced in the 70s. Now, it's one thing for the public to demand action of its elected officials, of its appointed officials, when you can see, taste, and feel the pollution, when you can take a picture of the pollution and put it on the evening news. The climate change challenge is more subtle, it is more complex, and solving these challenges is even more important to our future than the work we have already done. In many ways, despite the progress we have made, the work we have done was simple compared to what lies ahead. The global emissions of industrial carbon dioxide pollution, a greenhouse gas, has more than quadrupled since 1950. The atmosphere contains over 30% more carbon dioxide than at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And I don't have to tell most of you, I would think, that leading scientists around the world have formed a consensus that the phenomenon of climate change is real. The impacts are significant, and we need to take action before the results become our reality. The Academy of Sciences found that 98% of scientists agree that climate change is real, human-caused, and underway. 98% of the scientists. Now, climate change manifests itself not just in higher temperatures in our atmosphere, it's earlier springs, it's longer summers, it's stronger hurricanes, more tornadoes. This year, in April, we had 600 tornadoes in the United States. In 1 month, we had 600 tornadoes. That is double the previous 1 month record. It means harsher winters, rising sea levels. You know, it starts to sound like a Hollywood movie disaster. Unfortunately, it's not a movie, it's real. The impacts of many of the environmental challenges we have faced to date were reversible. We were able to remove raw sewage and many toxic chemicals from our rivers and lakes. The Cuyahoga River is today fishable. But many of the effects of climate change, such as sea level rise, are not reversible. You know, one of the great things of working at EPA are the wonderful engineers you get to work with. There's not an engineer in the world that will be able to reverse the sea level rise once we start to see the infiltration in our freshwater supplies. To fail to act now is to leave to future generations not simply a river on fire or a toxic waste dump to be cleaned up, but an irreversibly changed planet. Generations after generations have left problems and challenges to those who came after them, but no generation has of yet left a permanently changed planet. Now, there are lots of naysayers. They're getting a lot of attention right now. The climate deniers, there's all kinds of different things you can call them. They're vocal, they're loud, they're organized, they're well-funded. They argue that we need more evidence, that we need more science. They question the veracity of the scientists. They discount the mountain of scientific evidence and consensus. The full-time client climate science deniers have become what some people call merchants of doubt. Much like the tobacco industry, when they questioned the link between cigarettes and cancer, the goal is to create enough uncertainty about the link between pollution and climate change that the political battle will revert back to whether the problem exists rather than how to solve it. But again, answer this. How do we reverse sea level rise once low-lying islands are flooded and fresh drinking water supplies infiltrated? How do we turn back another Class 5 hurricane like Katrina? How do we stop the rain and flooding of homes and neighborhoods in North Dakota or Tennessee? How do we make it rain in drought-stricken Texas? 40 years ago, with unprecedented public commitment and support, we accepted the challenge of environmental and public health protection. We accepted it as a moral and ethical responsibility. And it is exactly that commitment and the tools that have served us to date that must form the basis for meeting the challenge of climate change. First, we must be willing, as we have been, to set strong pollution reduction standards and strong public health and environmental safeguards, even if there still may be some scientific questions to answer, another study to be done. Remember, that is the very nature of science itself. It will always ask another question, do another study, conduct another test. Standards must be based on a body of evidence, an analysis, review, the weight of the science available, but the fact that some scientists continue to study a matter should not, in and of itself, be enough to delay the decision. John mentioned the fine particle standards. Those standards were set because we had a body of evidence that showed that millions of Americans, predominantly older Americans, were being adversely affected. And we made a decision as a country to set the standards, reduce the sulfur and diesel, and that has contributed to lives saved. More than 30 years ago, we made an important public health decision to ban lead in gasoline. What the scientists told us then was that lead in gasoline, exposure to lead from gasoline, was lowering IQ levels in children. They couldn't tell us how many IQ points, they couldn't tell us with absolute certainty which child or when the effects would occur. But we did decide as a country, based on the available science, based on the weight of the evidence, to phase out lead in gasoline. Should we have waited another 10 years to see how the lead affected children of the 70s fared in the 80s before we acted? If we had waited to know precisely how many IQ points were being lost, another generation of children would have suffered needlessly, would have been harmed needlessly. A tragedy for them, a blow to our economy, a blow to our society. We must be prepared, as we have been in the past, to set standards based on the weight of the evidence. Second, we should count on American ingenuity to solve our challenges. We must be willing to set public health standards, even sometimes not fully understanding at the moment we set them how we are going to meet them, not fully understanding what the technological solution will be. Good old American innovation and ingenuity have served us well in this field and can continue to serve us well. Once our goals are set and deadlines are clear, our engineers, our scientists have proven time and time again that they can meet those standards cheaper, faster than the industry originally predicted. When faced with a goal, we rise to the challenge. When the U.S. banned chlorofluorocarbons, I was actually working in the United States Senate for then Senator Gore during the debate of the Clean Air Act of 1990. And there were very wise senators who took to the floor to say, if we ban CFCs, which is what we were using in refrigeration at the time, we won't have air conditioning in our cars. We won't have refrigerators in our homes. But we made the decision to ban it. There wasn't an alternative available, but in making that decision, we created an opportunity, an investment opportunity, a market opportunity, and much more quickly and at much lower cost, a substitute became available. And this race to market was a good thing. People created jobs, they created new industries, they created new opportunities. So we have to be willing to set standards when the science tells us, even if we don't know precisely how we will meet it. Third, we must be willing to set public health and environmental standards even when the predicted costs appear to be greater than the benefits. What we found, again, when we look back over history, is that time and time again, the benefits of reducing pollution are generally greater than originally estimated, and the cost significantly less. Acid rain is a great example. 25 years ago, there was a lot of debate in this country about reducing acid rain. It was destroying our forests, it was ruining our lakes. The electric utility industry did an analysis of what it would cost for them to reduce acid rain, to reduce SO2, which causes the acid rain. And what they concluded is it would be approximately $1,000 per ton of sulfur dioxide reductions. EPA did a study, John was probably there, it was before I was at EPA, and EPA concluded that it would be about $600 per ton. Well, we've actually significantly reduced SO2 in this country, and we've done it for about $200 per ton. And so what we learn is that we get smarter, that the cost become less than we originally anticipate, and the benefits become greater. EPA recently concluded a study of the total health benefits of the Clean Air Act over a 20-year period beginning in 1990. And what they found is that the benefits outweigh the cleanup cost almost 20-1. And the benefits are not just cleaner air or safer water, better public health. There can also be new jobs. When we set new requirements, someone is going to design the scrubber, someone is going to have to build it, install it, maintain it. All good American jobs. Last month, the National Journal determined that industry arguments that say that installing scrubber technology at power plants would cost jobs were inaccurate, and instead that each scrubber could create more than 1,000 jobs. Now, I want to be clear. I do think that cost-benefit is an important analytical tool. I think we started doing them when I was at EPA in a robust manner. I think the agency should continue to do them. It should inform the debate. It should inform the decision. But it should not be the sole basis for setting a standard. If we do that, we simply sell ourselves short. If we limit our environmental and public health protections to only those where it can be clearly demonstrated on the front end that the benefits outweigh the costs. Now, sadly, we seem to have returned to an old argument in Washington, and I guess across the country, that somehow or another we have to choose between our economy and the environment, that we have to choose between livelihoods and our lives, that we can't have both a healthy environment and a strong economy. If we've learned anything over the past 40 years, it is that we don't have to choose. I recognize we're in difficult economic times. Obviously, everyone recognizes that. But I had the opportunity to serve 8 years in administration, began with some difficult economic times, was able to reverse those, and set the toughest public health and environmental standards that had ever been set in the history of our country. We do not have to choose. And in fact, I believe that a strong, healthy economy helps protect the environment, and that a protected, clean environment helps grow the economy. In Congress, we need to address our energy and climate challenges. Unfortunately, what we have right now is nothing but a bipartisan spat. All we do is argue in Washington, with both political sides seeking political advantage instead of working on consensus solutions. Gone are the days of bipartisan belief and the need to protect public health by protecting the environment. So what changed? Why did the politics of environmental protection change? What happened to the days of bipartisan support? I think it's two things. I think it's money, and I think it's television. Getting elected costs a lot of money these days. John mentioned that my husband is here. He served in Congress. He was elected at 25. In 1974, when he first ran for office, it cost him $60,000 to be elected to a congressional seat on Long Island in New York. In the early 80s, when I first came to Washington, the average amount of money a member of Congress had to raise was $360,000, and for the Senate, about $3 million. In 2008, the average cost for a House seat, $1.3 million. Now remember, they're doing this every 2 years, and for the Senate, over $7 million. And now we have the Supreme Court decision in Citizens United, which is putting us into uncharted territory. What the experts are saying is the outside money that will be spent in key congressional and Senate races will be even greater than, more than, what the candidate themselves are going to spend. In the last elections, thanks to the new rules, or maybe we could say the lack of rules set by Citizens United decision, industry sources pumped in $1.4 billion into the election cycle, and unions contributed $96 million. We also have a relentless 24/7 news cycle that feeds the fights in Congress. Our political leaders are constantly acting, reacting to issues based on the moment and not on the gravity of the issue or on the long-term impact of the policy. The relentless 24/7 news cycle prevents leaders from creating a narrative or making a sustained argument for taking action or creating new policy. We literally have televised shouting matches separated by commercials for exercise equipment and car insurance. John mentioned, you know, my 8 years at EPA, and there's a within a White House, they talk about the president's schedule, and they talk about how many public events will the president do in the course of a given week. And during the Clinton-Gore administration, they would talk about maybe two or three times when you would actually put the president out, and he'd speak on an issue for a period of time, and maybe he'd make a visit somewhere. 2 to 3 a week. In the Obama White House, we were doing 2 to 3 a day. And that is not because we want it to, that's because the demand of the 24/7 news cycle has changed so dramatically that all of the elected officials, appointed officials, feel this need to constantly be feeding this beast, and you really cannot sustain any kind of narrative. John mentioned the ozone standards and the fine particle standards that we set when I was at EPA. It was literally an 8-month discussion with the American people. We were traveling the country, listening to people. The New York Times reported on it continually. Papers were editorializing on it. By the time we actually made that final decision, many, many people, more than a majority of the people in this country, knew what we were talking about. They had been part of a conversation. EPA recently considered setting a new ozone standard. I don't think 10% of the American people knew EPA was even considering it. It has become very, very hard to sustain a conversation, a narrative about what we need to do in this country. Now, one of the things I have been very committed to, and one of the reasons I chose to go back to the White House, the president created an office that had never existed before, and I went back to set that up and run that, is because I really believe we need a different energy future for our country. We need a clean energy future that we can build a clean energy economy, and that in doing that, we can reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And in order to do that, what we need are the right public policies. And I've talked about the tools and the mechanisms we've used to set those requirements, to establish those policies. But we've also have a long history in this country of making investments in new technologies. It's a proud history of supporting our nascent industries. In 1913, when we wanted to build the oil and automotive industry in this country, we established a whole set of favorable tax policies, and we made really important investments in that industry. 100 years later, we are still making investments in those two industries to the tune of $4 billion a year for just the oil and gas industry. That is what their tax breaks amount to. In the 1940s, we decided that nuclear technology should be an important part of our energy future, and we provided subsidies and tax incentives that continue today. Why won't we make the similar long-term commitment and investments in clean energy sources? If we do that, we can build a different energy future, we can reduce greenhouse gases, and we can put millions of Americans to work. The solar industry, this is technology we invented here in the United States. It's a little known fact, is today a net exporter of technology, net exporter, nearly $2 billion in exports last year to Europe and even some to China. But imagine how far we could go with our solar industry if we had a renewable energy standard, if we said that 15-20% of all the energy we generated in this country would come from renewables. Imagine how far we could go if we would make some modest tax adjustments. Right now, the solar industry will get a tax adjustment until 2016. They are literally getting it on a 2 or 3 year increments. Remember, the oil industry, more than 100 years of favorable tax policies. We need to make these kind of investments if we want to grow these industries. So what have we learned from our work of the last 41 years? That the environmental laws of a generation ago were wisely structured on a simple premise, a moral, ethical belief that we should protect those elements vital to our life, our air, our water, our land, our health. And that once having made the decision to protect public health by protecting our environment, we were able to figure out the most cost-effective, common-sense way to meet that commitment. And so it should be with climate change. We must rededicate ourselves to solving this challenge, to set the standards based on the best available science, and then work together to find the solutions, just as we have done before. Now, I'm not suggesting this will be easy, but I do believe it is really important to begin, that further delay will only make it more difficult and expensive. And that even though the challenges of climate change are greater than any other environmental challenge we have faced, I do want to say that I believe we will rise to the challenge, that failure is simply not an option, and that we will not be the first generation to leave to another a problem they cannot solve. I thank you for your time, I thank you for coming, and I thank John for the honor of being with you all today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.